This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we explore ADHD, Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, what we know about it today, and answers to how best to treat this problem. Plus, what causes those painful kidney stones, and what can you do to prevent them? But first, how a simple blood test may someday help quickly diagnose a stroke. Well, it's estimated that as many as 5.1 million Americans may have Alzheimer's disease, and the incidence of the disease is rising in line with the aging population, prompting the growing need for new and more effective ways to diagnose and treat Alzheimer's and other neural diseases. Well, here on with more on a new effort underway to do so is Dr. Sharon Brangman. She's Professor of Medicine, Division Chief of Geriatrics, and the Director of the Central New York Alzheimer's Disease Assistance Center at Upstate Medical University. Dr. Brangman is here with us in our studio, but joining us on the telephone as well from his office at Cornell University is her colleague on this project, Dr. Alexander Travis. He's Associate Professor of Reproductive Biology at the Baker Institute for Animal Health at Cornell University. Welcome, Dr. Brangman.
Hi, thank you.
And welcome, Dr. Travis.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Brangman, you've just been given this grant, along with Dr. Travis, to embark on a very exciting project. Can you give us an overview of what that is?
So, I got a call from Dr. Travis, who was assembling a team to look at biomarkers in various neural diseases. So, on our end at Upstate, we're going to help by bringing in patients with various dementias, including Alzheimer's disease. And then there's a campus in Buffalo that's going to evaluate patients with stroke. And then there's also a group in Albany where we're looking at head traumas such as concussions. And so the whole idea is to find out ways of early identification that might be even done on the field, on the soccer field, in the ambulance while somebody's being brought in with a stroke, to help doctors and healthcare providers make a diagnosis as early as possible.
So you're basically trying to get basically rapid and sensitive, handheld, I think, biosensor platform to be able to determine whether people either diagnose and then later treat people with neuropathology. So you've mentioned stroke, in your case, Alzheimer's disease, and even traumatic brain injury.
Correct. So early information is very important, especially with strokes and brain injury like a concussion, so that people can be identified and interventions can be put in place right away, because that helps to save brain tissue.
How much money were you given to do this?
So the initial amount was $150,000 that went to Cornell. And then as a co-PI, we have pieces of that budget to help carry out the experiments and the projects here on this campus.
Now, you mentioned a couple of other collaborators. So you have Upstate Medical University, and you mentioned, obviously, Cornell. Who else is going to be helping you?
Buffalo, SUNY Buffalo, and SUNY Albany.
Very good. Well, Dr. Travis, I have to turn to you now because you really are the driving force here from the technical side and the biomedical side. And you're engaged, I guess, in the development of this biosensor. Can you tell us, first of all, what is a biomarker?
Okay. Biomarkers are substances that are found usually in the patient's bloodstream that correlate with the presence or onset of a certain disease. For example, Alzheimer's disease, as Dr. Brangman mentioned. And so these would be substances that you could detect, and their presence would then tell the doctor that, yes, this patient has, say, brain injury in some way.
And how would you detect it? Through the use of, I know you're going to be telling us, excuse me, more about how the actual technology works, but is it through a blood sample? Is that the idea?
Well, exactly. So what we're the grand vision for what we're trying to create is a little handheld device that you could put a few drops of blood in, and at the same time, it would be able to detect a number of different biomarkers. So you could think of a little card that would slide into a reader, which would be very similar to a digital camera. And then within a matter of minutes, this would tell you whether biomarker X, Y, or Z was present.
So help us understand, currently, I've heard a lot of research being done currently in different areas to look for biomarkers. And how are they doing it currently, and how is it different than what you're attempting to do?
Yeah, so many labs are looking for biomarkers of different disease. And what we're working on is actually on how do you detect them. Once you identify that biomarker, how can we detect that very quickly? Most of the current applications are using antibodies, and they will very specifically recognize and bind to a biomarker. But that takes a long time. Most of the kits that are designed to do this will take 2, 3, 4 hours even. And oftentimes that's too long for being convenient for use in a clinical exam in a doctor's office, or especially if you're in an ambulance after an injury or suspected stroke.
And so what are you proposing to use that's different?
Yeah, so our system is something we call TET, for tethered enzyme technology. And what we've done is figured out ways to use enzymes to detect different biomarkers. And we attach those enzymes or tether them to things like nanoparticles, very, very small particles that we can put in different parts of this sensor device so that we can have different channels or lanes that would detect different biomarkers. So it's a way of miniaturizing it and also making it much, much faster, because enzymes typically act hundreds to thousands of times faster than an antibody can recognize a biomarker.
So you're really making a point here that the speed of diagnosis, especially in some of these disease entities that we've talked about, like traumatic brain injury, concussion, and certainly stroke, is of crucial importance.
Absolutely.
So speed is really the driving force here.
That's very true. And so what we've done in our early studies in the lab is have samples that have different or known amounts of biomarker in them, and we'll use our tethered enzyme approach, and we'll compare it to the antibody approach. And we usually get very, very similar results, but ours we get in 5 to 10 minutes, whereas these antibody-based kits, again, 2 to 4 hours.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with geriatrician Dr. Sharon Brangman and research scientist Dr. Alexander Travis. We're talking about the use of biomarkers to diagnose neural diseases like Alzheimer's or traumatic brain injury. And we're also talking about a new, very new concept in how to get these biomarkers and how to detect them. So obviously, the use of antibodies, instead of using antibodies, you're using enzymes. But there's got to be, well, first of all, can you describe exactly when you say this tethered enzyme technology? Help us understand a little bit better what you do. What is this TET?
So the first step is identifying which biomarker we want to go after or what we want to identify. And then we figure out, can we use enzymes? And it's usually not just one enzyme, but two or three, that together we can change detecting that into an emission of light. And so what our enzymes are actually doing is not only, say, interacting with the biomarker, but then changing that interaction and ultimately reducing light. And that usually takes a couple of steps. And by attaching our enzymes to nanoparticles, we can bring all those steps together in a very, very close, tight space so that with only a few drops of blood, very small volume, you can detect then that biomarker. And the reader that I mentioned before would basically be like a fancy digital camera that would be able to detect the light emitted from each of these lanes.
So the key way of being notified, or the key element here, is that they produce light, and light would be a positive response to the existence of a biomarker. Help us understand very briefly, when you say nanoparticles, it's so fascinating to most listeners not to really understand what that is. Tell us, what is a nanoparticle?
So a nanoparticle is something that is extremely, extremely small. And these could be, you could fit thousands of them in a period at the end of a sentence.
you mean in an actual physical period at the end of a sentence?
Yes.
Okay. And where do they exist? Where do we find these nanoparticles?
So nanoparticles are typically made. Most of the ones that we use now we can buy commercially. And you can get them in different sizes, and you can get them made of different substances. And so depending on the application, they can be made of silica, or they can be made of gold or metal like iron. So all different kinds for different applications.
So different elements, and then you basically use those to attach the enzymes, or you attach the enzymes to those particles, and then you can place them in various locations for use.
Exactly.
So tell us, it's very interesting, and I don't want to run out of time, but we have enough time, I think, for you to explain the background, because it's fascinating. How did you develop this concept of tethered enzyme technology? I understand it had something to do with how sperm get the energy to swim. Can you explain that?
Yes, actually. So my training in my laboratory is in reproduction, and we were studying how sperm get the energy to swim for their very, very long tail. And they have a really cool system where they attach a set of enzymes that can metabolize sugar and make it into energy. And they attach these enzymes to a solid structure that runs down the major length of the tail. So essentially, they've created a solid state system for energy production. And we just said, wow, that would be a really cool thing to copy, because you could make then basically an engine for very small medical devices that could be implanted in a patient's body, maybe even in their circulation, where they could use sugar in the bloodstream as a fuel and then make energy to carry out their function of delivering a drug or performing some other mechanical function.
So that had other applications other than this biosensor that you're talking about.
Exactly. So we were really trying to build an engine for a car of the future, a medical device that hasn't been really built yet. And so as we've been working on this and we've gotten a whole bunch of enzymes to work when attached to nanoparticles now, then the idea was, well, now we've got these enzymes, what can we do with them now, today? And that's when we started to work on diagnostics of biomarkers.
It's fascinating. So currently, just remind our listeners and all of us how you envision this technology being translated into a real setting. You started describing the idea of perhaps in an ambulance or what have you. Run us through it one more time.
Right. And so this would be, there would be different cards that would be useful for detecting different sets of biomarkers. For example, one card could be for Alzheimer's, one could be for stroke or traumatic brain injury. And the doctor, or say the paramedic, would take a few drops of the patient's blood, put it into the device, and then the blood would be, the serum of the blood would be separated into different channels, each one that would be designed to detect a different biomarker. That card would just slide into a handheld reader device, and if the biomarkers are present, light will be emitted from each of those different lanes, and the amount of light will tell us how much of those different biomarkers are there.
That's incredible. That truly is. What do you think the timeline is from concept to actual prototype?
So we have right now the enzymes working on nanoparticles. And what we're doing with Dr. Brangman and SUNY Buffalo is now looking at patient samples. We've done this in the lab. We've gotten some preliminary data on some human patient blood, but we really now need to look at it with larger numbers of patients and say, you know, will this work now in people using human blood? And then at that point, we could have a first-generation device that maybe this would be done not in a card and with a handheld reader, but in plates that would be designed to go into existing readers that would be in a clinical laboratory.
Well, I'm going to have to stop you there because I have one last question for Dr. Brangman, which I think is of crucial importance. Dr. Brangman, how do you see this playing out in a clinical setting, briefly?
Well, in Alzheimer's disease, it's a little bit different than making an immediate diagnosis for someone having a stroke or a concussion, for example. But we do struggle with people who have symptoms that may not be typical for dementia or Alzheimer's disease. And we don't have a really good way of detecting early disease, which may occur many years before we see clinical symptoms. So I see this as being an important tool that might be used in that regard. There's a little bit of concern because we don't have any cure for Alzheimer's disease. So there's a lot of implications for identifying a very serious illness without a way of intervening. But this could also begin to help us identify ways of intervening or delaying the disease and maybe monitoring drug therapy there's a whole lot of applications that could come out of this that I think are very important and exciting.
It sounds very exciting to me, and I want to thank you both very much for this information. My guests have been Dr. Sharon Brangman. She's professor of medicine, division chief of geriatrics, and the director of the Central New York Alzheimer's Disease Assistance Center at Upstate Medical University. And Dr. Alexander Travis, thank you so much. He's associate professor of reproductive biology at the Baker Institute for Animal Health at Cornell. Maybe you'll come back and tell us a follow-up as to what you actually do find and how this works. Once again, thank you so much. Next up, what we now know about ADHD today. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Health experts say that ADHD, that's attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, is the most common behavioral disorder that starts during childhood. However, it does not only affect children. People of all ages can suffer from ADHD. And the ramifications of having this disorder are many and far-reaching. We'll hear with more on this as Dr. Stephen Ferrone, a distinguished professor of psychiatry at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Ferrone. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Linda.
So first, help us understand, what do we actually mean by the term ADHD, which I know stands for Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder?
So ADHD, it's a disorder that starts in childhood, before the age of 12, by our diagnostic requirements. It consists of three syndromes, if you will. There's inattention, inability to pay attention to things that are happening, particularly in the classroom, which is makes schoolwork difficult. Hyperactivity, the little child running around too much, climbing on furniture, causing trouble. And impulsivity, acting without thinking. The child that loses a ball, rolls into the street, and they run into the street without looking for cars. Impulsive behavior.
Is this the same as ADD? I know those terms.
Yes.
One preceded the other. Explain that.
Well, yes. But what happens is that as the diagnostic nomenclature, as we call it, progressed over time. And in the 1980s, we used the term ADD, attention deficit disorder, and it was diagnosed with or without hyperactivity. So people called it ADD. And that term has actually stuck with us today. People use the term ADD, even though later on, by 1990, we changed the term to attention deficit hyperactivity disorder to really convey the sense that both sets of symptoms were prominent in the disorder, that the hyperactivity wasn't less prominent than the inattention. So it was merely a change in the name that helps doctors think about it. But still, some days people will talk with ADD, and it's really the same thing.
So they are the same. And is it true, then, you really can't have one without the other? I mean, you can't have the attention problem without the hyperactivity, or can you?
Actually, you can. You can have one without the other. In fact, the way the disorder is diagnosed, it's possible if you have many, many symptoms of inattention, you can be diagnosed as having ADHD, and the doctor will code primarily inattentive, or you can have ADHD where you're mostly hyperactive impulsive, and the doctor will code it that way, or you can have what we call combined ADHD, where you have both. But we consider it one disorder, and the treatments are the same for the disorder, regardless of the subtype of it.
Today, what's the incidence? What do we say when we're talking about children?
In children, the incidence is about 5%, and that's pretty constant across the world. There have been probably, at this point, hundreds of studies that have been done in different countries, and the average is about 5%.
Has it increased or decreased or remained the same?
There's a big debate and misunderstanding, really, in the media in particular about that. The actual prevalence, meaning that if a researcher goes out into a community and looks at the prevalence of the disorder with standardized methods, that prevalence has not changed over time. What has changed over time is the you might think of it, the rate of diagnosed ADHD. The doctors are diagnosing more of it as determined by surveys in which we ask parents, is your child diagnosed with ADHD?
So also there could be more attention to it, in effect, or more awareness of it, leading to more frequent
exactly.
diagnoses.
And that's really the issue, are doctors doing a better job because they're identifying children with ADHD, or are they over-diagnosing the disorder? My view of it is that it's extremely important that children be diagnosed with this disorder as early as possible and as accurately as possible. And if we look at the diagnosis rates from the latest reports from the CDC, the diagnosis rate is about 5%, which is about the prevalence of the disorder. So my view of it is that doctors are doing a good job because they're actually diagnosing the disorder when it occurs.
Does there remain the controversy over its origin or its etiology, what causes it? In other words, first of all, do we really know what causes it? And secondarily, I know there's been some controversy suggesting either it's organic, meaning the kid comes wired that way, or there's something in the environment, maybe even neonatally, you know, or prenatally, that is making children this way.
Well, it's very clear. There's really no debate in the, I would call the serious academic world about ADHD. There's lots of debate in the news media. There's lots of debate on the internet. And most of that parents should ignore because there's mostly people who are saying things without the credentials to say them. They haven't read the scientific literature.
Or there's no evidence.
They haven't done the research studies. Or there's no evidence to support what they've said. So number one, be very careful at what you read in the media. Even the New York Times. I mean, there's reports in the Times that have errors in it that are, unbelievable, really, from my point of view. The causes of this disorder are extremely complex. I've been researching this for 30 years, and at the outset, I hoped it would be an easy problem to solve. It turns out it's a difficult problem. We know from twin studies, where you look at twins that are identical versus twins that are not identical, those studies tell us it's very clear that there's a strong genetic component, that genes play a fairly strong role.
So there's some wiring here.
So there's definitely some wiring that occurs early on. And most of the environmental risk factors that we know about also occur early in life. So, for example, if a mother is drinking too much alcohol during pregnancy, we think that affects the fetal brain and that affects ADHD. If the child is exposed to certain toxins, pesticides early in life, that can increase the risk. If a child is born, has problems, very low birth weight children are more likely to have ADHD later in life. Now, first of all, parents shouldn't get worried to think, oh, my God, I had two glasses of wine every night when I was pregnant. My child will have ADHD. It doesn't work that way. It's not as if these risk factors guarantee that you'll have ADHD. It's the cumulative effect of having many, many risk factors that leads to it. So, for example, a lot of my work is in genetics. We had hoped in the 1980s, 1990s, that there might be one, two, three, or four genes that we could discover that would be the causes of the genetic part of ADHD. It turns out what we know now, probably hundreds, maybe thousands of different genes combine to lead to what we call a susceptibility to the disorder.
And even at that, it's only the susceptibility rather than a definite direct relation.
Exactly. In some cases, there may be some rare cases where somebody has, for example, a large deletion of a chromosome. That might be a necessary insufficient cause. But those are very rare. The large majority of cases are created by a genetic susceptibility interacting with their environment.
So bottom line at this point is we don't really have a single answer to what causes it. It's obviously the nature and nurture concept here. Is it something in beyond the kind of environmental factors that you have just outlined, which are more kind of organic, meaning whether somebody is drinking, are there behavioral environments that could be more conducive to either its development or obviously its diminishment?
Right. So that's a good question. First of all, there's no evidence that parents cause ADHD. When psychiatry has gone away from blaming mothers for all childhood disorders.
Including autism, which was one of the big ones.
Including autism, including schizophrenia. There was the famous refrigerated mother that caused disorders.
Mm-hmm.
That's really been debunked. We do know, however, that children that live in, for example, chaotic family environments where there's a lot of conflict in the family, that increases their risk for a worse course of ADHD. Their ADHD will be worse, and a worse incidence of ADHD. So part of the therapeutic approach to ADHD is to try to modify the child's environment to lessen those types of problems.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink On Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with researcher and professor of psychiatry at Upstate Medical University, Dr. Stephen Ferrone, and we're talking about ADHD. Well, you've done all this extensive research, so help us understand some of the things that you've looked at and how that impacts potential treatment or help for children with this problem.
Well, fortunately, there are very good treatments for ADHD. They roughly fall into two categories. There's your medication treatments and there's your non-medication treatments. So in the medication treatments, the most famous one is Ritalin, which has received a lot of press in the United States and elsewhere. Ritalin is what we call a stimulant drug. It's also in the same class of drugs as Adderall, which is another drug that's pretty well known. But there are many drugs in this category. Vyvanse is a newer drug that has come out in this category. And there are others as well. The stimulant drugs operate in the brain on a molecule known as a dopamine transporter. And by blocking that transporter, we think it increases the amount of dopamine in the brain and helps to relieve the symptoms of ADHD. It turns out that these drugs are, if we look at all the drugs that are used in psychiatry for different types of disorders like schizophrenia, depression, et cetera, the ADHD drugs are actually among the most effective. These are actually extremely effective drugs that they don't cure the disorder. In other words, you don't just take it for a few weeks and then you're better. It's a lifelong, potentially lifelong treatment if your ADHD persists, and we can talk more about persistence later. There are also drugs that are non-stimulant drugs, another class of drugs. The most well-known one probably is Strattera. That's been around a long time, also known as atomoxetine. We have long-acting guanfacine, which is Intuinive, trade name Intuitive, and there's Capve, which is a long-acting clonidine drug. These non-stimulant drugs are also used to treat ADHD. They tend to be a little less effective than the stimulants, but they have the advantage of not having, there's a lot of regulatory requirements about stimulants because stimulants are potentially addictive. And many parents don't like taking stimulants for that reason.
And there's a lot of controversy around how many kids have been put on medication. It's almost like a knee-jerk, well, my kid is hyperactive, we're going to give them lifelong commitment to medication. So that has to raise some issues ethically as well.
Right. Well, it does raise issues, and that issue is best handled in the doctor's office, where the doctor makes an accurate diagnosis of the disorder. He treats the child with the appropriate medication, and if he decides medication is appropriate. Now, in some cases of milder ADHD, they might start with a family therapy. We can talk a bit about that later as well. That the ethical issue in my mind is the child getting the right treatment? And it's actually unethical to withhold treatment from a child who really needs it. And right. I think that's actually the biggest mistake that's frequently made.
Because I think one of the things that needs to be underscored is that when you have something like attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, your ability to learn, your ability to concentrate, your ability to make the most out of your environment is challenged. And
Absolutely.
Without that additional help, right. whichever form it takes, whether it be medication or some kind of a behavioral, you know, implementation
that's
of their environment,
right.
that child is really at risk.
Absolutely. There's a very big risk associated with non-medicated ADHD, which some parents don't understand. They worry about the risks of medication, and they forget about, my child's not being medicated, they're not making friends, they're not doing well in school. And those problems compound over time.
I don't want to run out of time. There's so many questions I have to ask you, and I know you have so many answers for me. Briefly, this can persist over a lifetime, ADHD. What do you see in adults, and how will somebody necessarily who's been diagnosed as a child be required to take medication throughout their lives?
Not necessarily. We know that about one-third of the cases by young adulthood, one-third of the cases go into complete remission. Their ADHD essentially disappears.
So they've grown out of it, so to speak.
They've grown out of it, and there are people who have done neuroimaging studies where they show that the brain actually changes in these people, and their brain, if you will, gets better. And they've grown out of the disorder.
Somehow they've matured out of it.
Somehow they've
matured.
Whatever
that means.
Exactly. And what doctors will do is that they will take the young adult or even sometimes a teenager off the medication for a while to see if they still need it. And that is good advice to test to see whether the disorder has indeed remitted.
But basically there are treatment modalities that incorporate changing the environment, helping them become more structured and
Absolutely.
All of that kind of thing. And they can be effective as well. But generally, is it a combination of the two that works best?
The combination is always a good idea. My approach would be one starts with medication. If that doesn't solve all the problems, then you deal with use family therapy to try to solve other problems. If it's an adult, you implement something called cognitive behavior therapy to help the adult learn to organize their world better. But that cognitive behavior therapy really doesn't work well unless the patient is also taking medication.
So that
them.
Combination really is kind of a crucial factor.
Absolutely.
Oh, I'm afraid we're going to be running out of time. Is there some overview statement you'd like to make in terms of what you would recommend to parents if they have concerns about ADHD?
I would say consult a mental health clinician, your pediatrician, a psychologist, a psychiatrist, as soon as possible. Don't wait. If you have a child who's 5 years old who seems like they're having trouble and you wait a year, that's one more year that they're exposed to all the problems of ADHD. The treatments that we have are sometimes very quick to work, and you'll know very soon if they work or they don't work.
Thank you so very much. My guest has been Dr. Stephen Ferrone, a distinguished professor of psychiatry at Upstate Medical University and obviously a world expert in ADHD. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Some expert advice from the experts at Upstate. We have Dr. Stephen Blatt. He's the director of the General Pediatrics Division at Upstate, and he's going to talk about the new New York State immunization guidelines for children. Welcome, Dr. Blatt.
Hi. When people think of modern medicine and all it has to offer, we often think of PET scans and MRIs and robotic surgery, but I really believe that the most significant achievements we've made in medicine have come through immunizations. And we've done such a wonderful job with immunizations that we've, in a sense, become a victim of our own success. So that in the 1950s, when polio vaccine came out and people were dying of polio all the time, everybody knew what polio was. Polio vaccine came out and people lined up for hours to get them. And nowadays, we've done such a great job in curing and preventing diseases, people forget about the importance of these immunizations. And they remain important today. One of the things that New York State has done this year is they've revised the immunization schedule a little bit, still in line with the national recommendations from the Centers on Disease Control, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and the American Academy of Family Practitioners. They've revised the guidelines to tweak it a little bit. And the main thing I think people need to know is that these vaccines are very effective, they're very safe, and because of the infrastructure, they're of no cost to direct out-of-pocket cost to our patients through either health insurance or Medicaid or vaccine for children program. And it's such an important thing. When kids go to kindergarten, they need a lot of shots to get there. And the number of shots will actually vary depending upon when they started. So if they start when it's recommended in infancy, they get shots 2, 4, 6 months, a year of age, 15 months, et cetera. There are some kids that don't start on time, and they'll actually need less shots to go to kindergarten. And that's why it's too complicated to discuss over a radio. You actually need a piece of paper to look at it to see the differences. But for most people, their new recommendations will have been met already if they've been going to their doctor all along. There are some people that don't get shots because they think they don't need them. Well, they do need them. In the last few years, there's been a number of people afraid to get measles, mumps, and rubella shot because of unfounded fears that have been shown to be not there. And in fact, they came about from some fraudulent research that was done trying to link MMRs to other illnesses. But now we see measles outbreaks all over the country. And measles could be a really bad disease.
So what's the takeaway? It sounds to me like not only is immunization crucial, but what are the key immunizations that kids need to have before entering kindergarten?
Well, they need about 11 different 11 different components. There's diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis. Pertussis is whooping cough, and whooping cough is a really bad illness. And actually, we now give that to pregnant women and other people in the household of a newborn baby because that could be a devastating disease for a child. Polio vaccine. Right now in Syria, because of their civil war, they've had a major polio epidemic. And polio is a devastating disease. Measles, mumps, and rubella. Chickenpox is one. Hepatitis B. Hemophilus influenza B for daycare and pre-K, as actually by the time you get to school-age children, they're not at risk for that, so they don't get it. And the other one, also for the younger children, is pneumococcal vaccine. So for both for daycare, preschool, and then for school-age, there are a number of vaccines that are very important. They will save your child's life.
Coming up next, what causes kidney stones, and how can you prevent them? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Welcome back to HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen with your Healthy Monday Minute for the week of August 25th. Be a buzz kill. Most of us see nothing wrong with our morning cup of coffee, but excessive caffeine can have a negative impact, especially if you're already stressed. Caffeine increases your blood pressure, heart rate, and adrenaline levels, making stressful situations seem and feel worse than they actually are. This week, try reducing your caffeine consumption, especially if you know you have a stressful day ahead. Replace your usual fix with extra sleep at night and more water throughout the day. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Kidney stones, they affect almost 4 million people in the United States each year, and the number of cases is on the rise both here and across the globe. But the causes for this rise remain unclear. Despite their cause, they can be a quite debilitating and very painful problem. We'll hear with more on this and what you can do to prevent their formation is Dr. Stephen Knoll. He's Associate Professor of Medicine and the Residency Program Director and Vice Chair for Education at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Knoll. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for the invitation.
So kidney stones are on the rise. Help us understand, though, what exactly are they?
Kidney stones are best way to describe it is think of like table salt, okay? And you can have these salts, so it can be sodium chloride like table salt or other salts like calcium oxalate that literally become solid in the kidneys and form what are called kidney stones.
So they're like little balls or little calcifications or...
Well, I would say the best way to describe it is really that they are things that are in liquid that become then solid. They may look like a ball, but they can be of various shapes and sizes.
And different sizes, like from the for a grain of sand to a golf ball.
Absolutely.
Right. So they form, repeat that again, remind me, they form in the kidney.
They form in the kidney, in the urine.
So why do they create so much pain?
Well, when you get a stone, and the stone is then trying to pass, your pipe that connects the kidney to the bladder, called the ureter, it moves the urine through what we call peristalsis. It's sort of a combination of the nerve cells and the muscle cells to help move that urine through. And when you have a blockage, for example, from a kidney stone, you're going to get more of this peristalsis, and that creates a tremendous amount of pain. So it's not really the stone itself that's causing the pain. It's the response to the stone that's causing the pain.
It's little contractions.
Yeah.
Almost, exactly. I hate to draw this analogy, and maybe this is not the same, but like in childbirth, you're having those continuous contractions
similar.
The uterus. And so this is on the ureter,
yeah,
is getting contracted, so it's a lot of pain.
That's right.
Do we have a clue as to why they're on the rise?
There are probably a number of factors. Certainly, if we look at the obesity epidemic, there's definitely been a rise in stones that seems to be very much related to the rise in weight. The increase in diabetes, which again may also be tied to the obesity epidemic, certainly there's a link between diabetes and stones. There's some discussion about whether or not temperature change across the globe may have some role. Certainly, if we're talking about things coming out to make stones, the best way to prevent is to keep them in the solution, and the best way is by more water. And if there's much higher temperatures, you may sweat more, which means less water to the kidneys.
So obesity and is diet, does diet play a role, for example, what you eat?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Whether or not that's directly tied to an increase is not entirely clear, because our diet has not been a tremendously healthy diet for decades. Although with the use of high fructose corn syrup, which sort of began maybe in the late 80s, again, there seems to be an increase in stones, but is it the high fructose corn syrup or is it the obesity that's resulted from the high fructose corn syrup is not entirely clear.
So why should weight or obesity add to the stone formation? That's not, I don't get quite that association.
It's not entirely been elucidated, but there's certainly very good data that the heavier you are, for example, or if you have diabetes, it alters the chemistry of the kidney and the way it handles certain substances, and it predisposes to easier stone formation.
That's interesting. So what happens is somehow that there's this concentration of these of the stone, and it kind of gloms together and makes the salts become kind of hardened. And is it purely, you said if there's more water, then the likelihood is less that the stones will form. So it's just really almost it's a concentration or a
that's exactly
it's the concentration of salt within a liquid.
Yeah, take a beaker and put some salt, Morton salt, in there, and then how do you dissolve it? You dissolve it by putting in water, and if you have enough water in there, it's not going to come back out to the salt anymore. It just stays dissolved in the solution.
So you also alluded to the higher global temperatures, and that's certainly been talked about with global warming.
Sure.
So you think worldwide with higher temperatures, therefore, as you said, people will sweat more, have less water within their bodies, and then potentially that's playing a role as well?
Well, that's certainly it's certainly a possibility. There's no absolute proof of that happening, just like there's a lot of debate about global warming. But certainly we know in this country, for example, we have what we call the Stone Belt, which is in the southwest and southeastern United States. Their temperatures are higher than, for example, our climate here in Syracuse. And the prevalence is much higher in those areas.
Oh, that's very interesting. Yeah. That really would point to it. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Stephen Knoll, and we're talking about kidney stones, what causes them, and then how to avoid them. So who's most at risk for stones?
If you look at the data, it appears that the young Caucasian male, generally the ages would be somewhere between 30 and 60 years old. Next would be Latino, followed by African American. Men do seem to outnumber women, although that gap is closing. It's not entirely clear why that's the case, although it is believed that obesity is playing a role there as well.
So once you get a kidney stone, are you more at risk for it recurring?
Absolutely. You're talking about your lifetime risk of having a second stone. That's probably about the flip of a coin. So you're down about 50%.
So there's something that happens within your body, or maybe whatever factors cause the first stone, unless you change them, will cause successive stones.
Most stones you can probably you could probably safely say are the result of some genetic predisposition that then with environmental changes is what leads to the stone, which means you're going to be at risk for future stones unless you modify the environment, since we really don't have the ability to modify the genetic predisposition.
Right. So does it tend to run in families?
Absolutely.
So you do see that strong genetic link there. Given the relationship to this higher temperatures outside that we were talking about and the fact that you might sweat more, is it more prevalent? Are they more prevalent in the summer months?
There seems to be a tick up in stones in the summer months. And in certain areas, there may be a tick up in the holiday season, not because of temperature, but because of dietary changes. So calcium oxalate stones are the most common stones in the world. You can oftentimes see a tick in the prevalence of that type of stone. For example, like maybe around Christmas in the Northeast, the use of strawberry rhubarb pie, Thanksgiving and Christmas time.
Really?
And strawberries and rhubarb are very, very high sources of oxalate. And so if you're not drinking as much, maybe because you're consuming a little more alcohol, you may be predisposing yourself to stones.
That's very interesting. So diet really plays a huge role.
Yep.
I mean, what you put into your body, as well as perhaps your genetic predisposition.
Yep.
But what you put into your body is really crucial here.
Absolutely.
In terms of the predisposition to it and perhaps controlling it.
Yep.
So to help us understand then, with all this in mind, mm-hmm. how can you avoid getting them? And we'll talk about then how to cope with them. What do you recommend people do to avoid getting them?
I think the most important thing, and if the only thing they remember from our interview today is what I'm about to say, then we did a great job, is you've got to drink. And
water.
Water is ideal, but
but when you say you've got to drink, people might think of that as
alcohol. Yeah, so step back. not alcohol. So water, any non-alcoholic beverage outside of maybe dark colas and the high fructose containing juices like the Kool-Aids, anything else is probably fine. Water is ideal. Lemon, so squeezing lemon into the water because it contains a substance that can inhibit stones called citrate. Your goal is to be drinking essentially an 8-ounce cup every hour you're awake. That's the goal if you've had stones to prevent further stones. And that is really the most important thing you can do. More
so
important
hydration.
Than any medications or any other dietary changes.
When you say you were mentioning lemons, would other citrus fruit play a similar role?
Some
like
citrus
limes
fruits,
or oranges
lime
or grapes?
Lime doesn't seem to have as much of an effect, but oranges certainly yes, but they also have a higher content of oxalate, so you have to be somewhat mindful.
So lemon water basically is ideal, is what you're saying. And how about diet? What should you be avoiding as far as food? In other words, is a diet higher in animal protein maybe more likely to cause stones?
Yep. So you'd want to, if you can, you'd at the very least, don't add salt to your foods. That's very important. If you can limit your salt intake, that will reduce your risk. Animal proteins are tied to calcium stones as well as uric acid stones. So if you can limit your intake of animal protein. And then if, depending on the type of stone you have, then it's important to, you know, see someone perhaps like myself who can then talk about what other measures are necessary.
And how about weight? Is that an important factor? You were mentioning obesity. Should you be looking to lose weight as a potential preventative measure?
Right, so weight is an important factor, but there haven't been any studies that have directly assessed weight loss and incidence of stone, so I can't answer that question.
How about calcium supplements?
So calcium, you should not restrict your calcium by any means. And however you need to get your calcium is probably fine, but you don't want to overdo it. So either through diet or through supplementation, it would be fine as long as you're not going overboard.
Well, that's really helpful. In the very little time we have left, what do you do if you have kidney stones? What's your recommendation?
If you have an attack, generally because it's so painful, you're going to wind up in an urgent care or an emergency setting. And then you may wind up seeing a urology doctor who then may have you see someone like myself to try to institute measures for prevention in the future.
So the key is obviously once you've had a kidney stone, you really are at greater risk to have it again, and you need to take a look at your diet, exercise, weight, and all of those things, and
that's
hydration,
right.
Crucially,
yes.
As the thing.
Yep.
Well, thanks so much. This is very, very helpful information and very, very important information. Any last thought? Hydration is the key.
That's the key, hydration.
Well, thanks so much. My guest has been Dr. Stephen Knoll. He's Associate Professor of Medicine, Residency Program Director, and he's the Vice Chair for Education at Upstate Medical University. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. When bad news comes, we deal with it as best we can. Later, we try to reconstruct where we were when it happened, how we felt when we first heard that life was changing. Poet, nurse, and ethics professor Amy Haddad gives us a powerful description of such news in her poem called From the Motel Window. Brake lights bleed on the gray snow as cars and buses move in and out of the teeming parking lot. Healthy and young, students and coaches trudge to the stadium entrance. A swim meet, the sign says. Their breath hangs in misty clouds over their heads. She stares down from the motel window while the tiny phone delivers crushing news. Every detail of the scene below is burned in her mind. She hears the words, all bad, tests inconclusive, multi-system failure, may not survive the night. But her attention is on the dirty snow, the cold she cannot feel, and the silence in the room. She pulls the curtains behind her and leans closer to the window, looking down, trying to listen. The grave voice on the phone asks about next steps. She knows there are none, merely laying the groundwork for death. She is trapped here, not where she should be. Forever, she will think this is what grief looks like, frozen on the other side of a transparent wall where you can see others move and breathe, but you cannot hear what they say or feel the cold on your face and in your throat.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Please join us again next week when we learn how to stave off Alzheimer's with daily exercise, plus all you need to know about depression, and how an Upstate program is helping to promote diversity in healthcare professionals. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLinkOnAir, all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can look for us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Cirio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.